Well, as we look at the book of Ezra and we begin a new series, I take as my text Ezra 1 verse 1. The Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put it in writing. We're going to look at Cyrus, king of Persia's heart in a moment. And we'll also think about the hearts of the family heads of Judah and Benjamin, and the priests and Levites in verse 5, whom God has moved to go up and build the house of the Lord in Jerusalem. But first of all, in order to understand the context of Ezra, we have to look at the heart of another king. There's lots of mask wearing at the moment, but the real drama is actually what's going on in the heart. That can be covered, but what's really happening? And that was as true then as it is today. And there'd been no one who'd hardened his heart against the Lord as much as Belshazzar, co-regent of the mighty Babylonian Empire 2559 years ago, when there was a wild bout of feasting and drinking going on. The Babylonians, who decades earlier had invaded Jerusalem, overwhelmed the Jews and had taken them off into captivity, whilst looting all the sacred gold and silver vessels from their ruined temple. And now, these years later, Belshazzar had a great idea. Why not bring out those great sacred vessels of the Jews and use them for one mad, sensational binge? The whole thing is narrated for us in Daniel chapter 5. Now, just imagine what's going on in his heart. Come on, he said, this loutish king, bring out all those gold dishes and bowls. Bring out all the silverware. The Jews may have used them for their ridiculous god. We'll show the real way to use gold and silver. Wouldn't it be fun to toast his gods in this exotic way? So he takes what belongs to God, what was meant to honor God, and mocks God by honoring other gods instead. So there are numerous toasts to these other gods of wood and of steel or whatever it is. And it was a deliberate act of public contempt. And so that night, actually, we know it, the 16th of October, 539 BC, in his magnificent throne room that has been excavated, measuring 52 meters by 72, complete with white plaster on three of the walls, there was a huge blasphemous feast. And suddenly, the fingers of a human hand appeared and wrote on the plaster of the wall near the lampstand. It must have felt like a meteor crashing in on a busy street. The real owner of those temple cups brings the entire party to a deadly silence. The room goes from being an orgiastic feast to a courtroom or even an executioner's chamber. And Daniel the prophet, now an old man, whom Belshazzar has utterly sidelined and ignored, is called up to interpret the terrifying writing on the wall. They find him, and there's the writing. Mene, mene, tekel, parson. Mene. God has numbered the days of your reign and brought it to an end. Tekel. You've been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Parson. Your kingdom will be divided and given to the Medes and Persians. So here is the word from eternity and a sentence of judgment. You did not honor the God who holds in his hands your life and all your ways. And that was the last night of Belshazzar's life. Darius the Mede, who was co-regent with Cyrus from the Persian Empire, took over Babylon that night. The ancient historian Herodotus fills in the details of the conquest, telling us the invading Persians had diverted a river and sneaked into the city along the dried riverbed. The Babylonian tyranny was over, and 17 days later, Cyrus entered Babylon himself. And that's the cue for the book of Ezra. That's the context, that terrible act of rebellion, the judgment on it, the disposal of Belshazzar. And here we are, Ezra 1. Now, can you see what God moved Cyrus, the king of Persia's heart, to be concerned about? Here's the key focus of the book. Let's have a look together. So it's verses 2, 3, and 4. What's the key focus here as we look together? Here it is. This is what Cyrus, king of Persia, says. The Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kings of the earth, and he's appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any of his people among you may go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of the Lord, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem, and may their God be with them. And in any locality where survivors may now be living, the people are to provide them with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. The temple comes in this pagan document three times. So why was the temple so important? Why did it have to be rebuilt? Well, we have to realize the place the temple occupied in Jewish life and thinking. Everything revolved around the temple and what it symbolized. It wasn't just another ancient monument. No, the temple was the place where people would go to meet God. It was the means by which God lived among his people. At the temple, people could go to God by making a sacrifice at the altar. It was the only place where you could meet God by sacrifice. So if you hear that judgment on Belshazzar and you feel some of its force as the verdict on your own life, Rico, God has numbered your days. You've been weighed in the balance and found wanting. Then this is where you can go to get forgiven. If you're thinking, gosh, the God who made me, if he weighed my life, what would he do? Well, you go to the temple to be forgiven. So sacrifices were offered there to atone for the sins of God's people. Of course, these sacrifices themselves weren't effective to remove guilt. That could only come through the once-for-all sacrifice of Jesus on the cross, Hebrews 9, verses 13 and 14. The blood of goats and bulls and the ashes of a heifer sprinkled on those who are ceremonially unclean sanctify them so that they're outwardly clean. How much more then will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself unblemished to God, cleanse our consciences from acts that lead to death so that we may serve the living God? It was the cross of Jesus that all these sacrifices pointed to, but only his death could utterly cleanse us from sin, as he died to save us from hell through the cross for heaven. So these many sacrifices at the temple in the Old Testament were a bit like the cover note that the post office used to provide from car insurers before the documentation was complete. The payment hadn't yet been made. Your check hadn't yet gone through. But the insurers knew it was coming. The sacrifices were like that cover note. Your sin and guilt hasn't been dealt with, but we know the payment's coming. So the temple kept God's people covered. And take away the temple, and how can you be forgiven? Take away the temple, and how do you know God is with you? So the rebuilding of the temple wasn't simply the restoration of a building. It represented a vital stage in the rebuilding of a nation around their relationship with God. It's what the entire book of Ezra is about. And in order for the temple to be rebuilt, two things had to happen. In verse 3, and again, this is a pagan document, but in verse 3, King Cyrus says people have to go up to Jerusalem to rebuild it. And in verse 4, people are called to give so that the resources are in place to make the reconstruction happen. You've got to go and you've got to give. Now, while those instructions may have come from Cyrus, a pagan king, they could have just as easily come out of an All Souls Thanksgiving and Gift Day. That's what has amazed me as I've been preparing. In order for the world to hear about God's forgiveness and his presence, you have to go and you have to give. People have to be sent and people have to be resourced as they're sent. Frederick William III was the king of Prussia in 1813. To strengthen the country, he carried out an extremely expensive program of public works, but he ran out of money. After careful reflection, he decided to approach the women of Prussia and ask them to bring their jewelry and gold and silver to be melted down, to be made into money for their country. Then he resolved that for each ornament of gold or silver, he would give in exchange a decoration of bronze or iron as a token of his gratitude. And each decoration bore the inscription, I gave gold for iron, 1813. The response was overwhelming. And what was even more important was the fact that these women prized their gifts from the king more highly than their former possessions of jewelry. The reason was clear. The decorations were proof that they'd sacrificed for their king. Indeed, it's a matter of recorded history that it became unfashionable for women in Prussia at that time to wear jewelry. So the order of the Iron Cross was established. Members of this order wore no ornaments except for a cross of iron for all to see. Surely what we need in the church today is an army of people who are so committed to the King of Kings that sacrifice becomes a way of life. They'll give and they'll go. They'll resource or they'll go themselves. So will you go and give and become a member of the Order of the Cross of Christ? It's a challenge here in Ezra. But where's the motivation to go and give? Well, it's in the phrase in verse 11, from Babylon to Jerusalem. Let me read you verse 11. In all, there were 5,400 articles of gold and silver. Sheshbazzar brought all these along with the exiles when they came up from Babylon to Jerusalem. Can you see the motivation here? From Babylon to Jerusalem. You see, to go from Babylon to Jerusalem is to be brought from captivity to liberation, from darkness to light, from guilt to forgiveness, from self to Christ, from hell to heaven. If we feel the wonder of what Christ has done, if we see what he's done on the cross so that we can be forgiven, just as these exiles suddenly were going from their exile back to their home city, if we feel that, well, then we'll hear this commission to go and give. It'll become our Christian calling. And it's not grudgingly offered. We're so amazed that we've gone from dark to light, from hell to heaven, that actually these are free will offerings because our hearts have been won. We're amazed at what Christ has done. It's a great phrase, from Babylon to Jerusalem. Let's ponder it. Let's ponder what it means for our future, for our eternity. As part of my morning routine, I used to almost always put on the news just to catch the headlines and be on top of what was going on. But I have to say, I've been put off that recently. I'm not sure I've quite got the energy for it early in the morning. Do you have the same problem as me? Just not got the energy for the news. For years, it was endless headlines about Brexit. And now there's almost nothing but coronavirus and the number of deaths leading the headlines. And when something else breaks through, it's normally because something even more appalling has happened. And aren't we left asking, as we sit spaced out and with our masks or in our bubbles, aren't we left asking, who's running this show? Who's calling the shots? Who's driving the thing? Now, most of us probably know the theoretical answer to that question, that the sovereign Lord rules. But how solidly have we grasped it? And are we still holding on to it at the moment when our child's school or university experience has been thrown up in the air? Are we still holding on to it while plans for the months ahead fall through? If you've had the pain of seeing loved ones made redundant, suffer, or perhaps even die from COVID-19, are you still holding on to it? It's all very well saying you're comfortable with the driver, but what about when the car seems to veer off the road and you can't see anyone in the driving seat? It's as though we've climbed into an Uber, confident in the 5-star rating of the driver, and started our journey quite happy while everything was running smoothly. But now we're in territory that we don't know so well, and the journey is feeling bumpy. And we're wondering if the 5-star reviews were submitted by real people. So we ask, who's driving the thing? What's going on? And that's one of the reasons Ezra is such a brilliant book to be selected by Johnny and Steve for the summer for us here at All Souls. Because as we travel about 3,000 miles in direction and 2,500 years back in time, Ezra, as he tells the story of the real life experience of real people at this crucial moment in the history of God's people, is crystal clear about who is driving everything and about who's in control. As we've seen from our verse this morning, Ezra 1 verse 1, in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and also to put it in writing. It's amazing, isn't it? Cyrus is a massive ruler, the Donald Trump of his day. He's just taken over the Babylonians. And what does he do with this bunch of captive exiles? Send them home? Really? Send them home? It's such an unlikely movement that for a long time people thought the Bible had made this up, this repatriation of the Jews. I mean, why would a non-Jewish king choose to send captives home to practice their religion? Literally, this chapter was used to prove the Bible was talking rubbish. And then, to the consternation of the academic world, the Cyrus cylinder was found 150 years ago. It's an ancient clay cylinder with a cuneiform script written on it, which you can go and look at in the British Museum. And though it doesn't mention the Jews by name, it confirms this repatriation policy. But why did Cyrus send them home? More than that, why did he send them home to build a temple to their God? Well, with, as we've seen, the government-mandated support of their neighbors, verse 4. I mean, he sends them home with this support. And in any locality, verse 4, where survivors may now be living, the people are to provide them with silver and gold, with goods and livestock, with freewill offerings for the temple of God in Jerusalem. What on earth could bring about that sort of movement? And it doesn't stop there. Listen to verses 7 to 10. Moreover, King Cyrus brought out the articles brought to the temple of the Lord, which Nebuchadnezzar had carried away from Jerusalem and had placed in the temple of his God. Cyrus, king of Persia, had them brought by Mithridath, the treasurer, who counted them out to Sheshbazzar, the prince of Judah. This was the inventory: gold dishes 30, silver dishes 1,000, silver pans 29, gold bowls 30, matching silver bowls 410, other articles 1,000. Can you imagine King Cyrus thinking, what about all those golden and silver vessels left out that night of Belshazzar's feast? There they were when my men marched in. My men were brave that night and they should be rewarded with some plunder. Or all that gold and silver could pay for a new palace, a new garrison, a new garden, a new university or school, another campaign. But then he thinks, no. They belong to the Jews. They were for their temple worship. Have we got the inventory? Mithridath, by the way, that word literally means belonging to the god Mithridates, replies, here's the inventory, sir. 5,400 gold and silver items. Right, give them to Sheshbazzar to fund the building of the temple. So why did Cyrus send them home? Why did he give up all this plunder? Why did he, as a pagan king, send them to build the temple and pay for it himself? Why did the people go and give? The answer is clear as crystal in verse 1. The Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, the king. Verse 4, everyone whose heart God had moved prepared to go and build the house in Jerusalem. And that was, of course, exactly where what Jeremiah had predicted would happen. Amid the ruins of Jerusalem, as the Jews were taken into exile, Jeremiah 29, verse 10. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I'll come to you and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place. Amazingly, Cyrus is even mentioned by name as an instrument in God's hands in Isaiah 40, verse 28 and Isaiah 45, verse 1. That is how in control God is. he names the man who's going to do the repatriation, this pagan king. Incredible. And here is the issue. We have the same God. Time and again in the book of Daniel, we're told the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes. That was the truth Belshazzar suppressed. But God is in control of history. He is in the driving seat. And we see that again and again in salvation history. It can't have seemed to Mary and Joseph that God was in control. When Mary, 8 months pregnant, was commanded by imperial edict to travel to Bethlehem. But the heart of Augustus Caesar, like the heart of Cyrus, was in the hand of the Lord. And so Mary and Joseph were forced to travel to Bethlehem for a census that was taken for the entire Roman world, so that scripture would then be fulfilled. And there they were, where the Messiah was predicted he should be, born in Bethlehem, as Micah 5 verse 2 had predicted 400 years before. And you don't think God is in control of history? That whole census organized to land the holy couple in Bethlehem at exactly the right time. So God can move the heart of Caesar, of Cyrus, of the family heads of Judah, who are inspired to go and give to build the temple. God is in control. And of course, it's Good Friday that reminds us of that fact. If he was in control on Good Friday, when all seemed in such disarray, when the sin of the chief priests, the sin of the Gentiles, the sin of Judas seemed to reign, if he was in control on that day, then he's in control today. And fulfilling his plan to bring people from Babylon to Jerusalem, from dark to light, from hell to heaven. To do that in your life, working out all things together for good. Now, the things may not be good, but they'll work out for good, which is to make me more like Christ, which is to bring me to eternity. Now, how do you remind yourself of that fact? Have I tried to remind myself of that fact in this pandemic? When you wake up each day and things seem so out of control, well, don't listen to the news first thing. Don't do that. Now, I have found an immense comfort not to listen to the news, but first thing in the morning to go and listen to some of our senior members pray at the All Souls prayer meeting each day of the week, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, not at the weekend, but on those 5 days at 8 a.m. And it's been amazing, brothers and sisters, to go to that prayer meeting and to listen to people like Tony and Ken, Mary, Bob, Allison and Elrose pray. It has kept me believing that the Most High is sovereign over the kingdoms of men and gives them to anyone he wishes, that God is in control, that he's working his purposes out. I never thought the prayer meeting would so minister to my heart to keep me understanding that the sovereign Lord is in control. It's been amazing. So the application of this sermon amidst this pandemic is come and pray. Come to that 8 a.m. prayer meeting. Come and hear the brothers and sisters, the senior members pray. Come and be reminded of the God who moved the heart of Cyrus, who moved the heart of Augustus, who was in control on Good Friday and is in control today as he leads us from Babylon to Jerusalem.